to Forward Thinking, a podcast on EDI in the Canadian post-secondary education landscape. This podcast is recorded at Wilfrid Laurier University, which is located on the Haldimand Tract, traditional territory of the Neutral, Anishinaabe, and Haudenosaunee peoples. This land is part of the Dish With One Spoon Treaty between the Haudenosaunee and Anishinaabe peoples and symbolizes the agreement to share, protect our resources, and not to engage in conflict. Each episode features scholars and others in higher ed who research inequity or are mobilizing research about inequities to shape Canadian campuses into inclusive spaces. My name is Hina Mistry, and I'll be your host for Forward Thinking.
This podcast focuses on equity, diversity, and inclusion in post-secondary education, but this conversation is incomplete without a discussion of what shapes student pathways into and through post-secondary. Equally important is the conversation about how equity, diversity, and inclusion can be embedded into teacher education. And so that's why in this episode, I'm really excited to be chatting with Marguerite Campbell. Marguerite is a part-time faculty at the Faculty of Education at Wilfrid Laurier University and a field supervisor for Bachelor of Education students. She's also part-time faculty at the Ontario Institute for Studies in Education, also known as OISE, at the University of Toronto. She has over 30 years of experience in education with the Toronto District School Board, where she began teaching elementary students and then moved to school administration as a vice principal and then principal. She has been seconded to both York University and OISE as a course director. Both of these cohorts were focused on equity, diversity, and urban education. She's been a central principal responsible for various curriculum areas, including science and outdoor education, both elementary and secondary. Marguerite recently retired as superintendent of education at the Toronto District School Board as well. So Marguerite, thanks so much for joining us today. We're so happy to have you.
Hina, thank you for asking me to do this. I'm quite excited to be here.
So in other places that you've sort of talked online in cyberspace, you've talked about your pathway into education, and so you mentioned that tackling literacy as an equity issue is one of the important things that sort of drew you to teaching in the first place. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about this and about how this has informed your work, both as a teacher, as school board administrator, and as someone who supports new teachers in their chosen careers as well.
In some ways, I think it might even be the other way around. I think my early experiences with young children and literacy really began to do that solidifying of literacy being an equity issue. I tell people it started my son's experience when he learned to read as a little boy before I was in teaching. And then when he started kindergarten and his kindergarten teacher said to me, in October, did you know your son could read? And I thought, yes, of course I know my son can read. And she said, well, I don't know what I'm going to do with him for the rest of the year. And I thought, what, you're not going to, nothing's going to happen with my child because he knows how to read in kindergarten? I don't understand this. And so that coincidentally was the year that I was at the Faculty of Education. And so began this sort of look at, well, why is it that my child, who I did not teach to read, we never did any letters or numbers. We read every day, obviously. And that immersive experience for him allowed him, because he's that kind of a kid, to engage in literacy in a way that other children didn't. And so as I started teaching then, of course, I realized that not all children come to literacy the way he did, and I mean, not even his sisters. And so I started then to think about what is it that, as I look around, why are there so many differences with literacy, and why are so many of those differences affecting the children who look like my children, who are children of color, who are children whose second language is not English, and also are children who begin life in poverty. And so what is that intersectionality of all that? And of course, those weren't the terms that I was using back then, but it was kind of beginning to look at me and say, wait, you know, there's something going on here beyond just the fact that your little boy knows how to read. And there's a teacher who looks at this little black boy and says, wait, Why is he reading so early? And I don't know what to do with this kid. And so there were obviously some very clear systemic issues that were involved. And again, back in the late 80s, I didn't have that language to talk about systemic issues of how children are treated, but it was very clear that there was something going on. And also we had a system back then where we would say to children who came from other countries, you know, make sure that they speak English, right? Don't, you know, they're coming from countries. Well, no. Don't speak to them in their own language. And I would think, but that makes no sense, right? Children who, literacy in any language is exactly the same. All children learn to speak. They all learn to read in whatever language they're learning to read, and they learn to write in whatever language. And so if you stop them from that process kind of at 3 or 4 or 7, there's going to be a disjointedness, and we are not, and not just not acknowledging their own home language, we are doing a disservice to them learning the English language. And so all of those things came together in terms of who was overrepresented in special education. And I know that there's been in history now, all of this research around the incarceration of men in prison and how much money we spend on incarcerating them rather than educating them, et cetera, et cetera. So I think to go back to the answer to your question, it really is about, there is no other way for us to allow students to be able to engage in life without literacy. And so that oral language, reading and writing, and we talk about going back to the basics, but really it is about engaging and being able to make choices in life by ensuring that everyone does it. I've also now kind of started to think that it's not just literacy. And I think, and again, this has been over a trajectory of time. It's now really, there's also technology involved in all of this, right? There is, how do we, if we decide in a world where there are those that have and those that do not, technology and literacy, when you have those two pieces, you are much better able to engage in a life of having. And I'm not just talking about having in terms of money. I'm talking about having a life that you choose. And it is becoming clearer and clearer to me that those basic literacy skills, the continued literacy skills, and the access and understanding and knowledge around how to use technology and how to use it properly is part of what I would consider now basic literacy skills.
I mentioned earlier that your teacher education work has focused on equity, diversity, and inclusion in urban education. So for listeners who aren't maybe familiar with that term, I was wondering if you could maybe explain what urban education is and how does that change the way that you teach Bachelor of Education students?
Well, I'd actually really like the term, right? I it was written in how they sent out these pieces. And I think I see it kind of has an American flair to this urban education. And I think what it's referring to is how we teach students who live we'd call them inner city neighborhoods that have very diverse populations, right? And I think the reality in most of the major cities in Canada is that we have multicultural neighborhoods, multi-ethnic, multi-language neighborhoods in most places in the major urban centers of Canada. Obviously, the Americans have many more large urban centers. So I think it is more referenced from an American perspective. However, I think what happens though is that, you know, we want to make sure that we don't have this divide between what we think about urban education versus rural education. And I think it really is more related to what we term now culturally relevant and responsive pedagogy, and looking at so that education is focused on equity, diversity, inclusion, and social justice. And I think that is a much better definition of urban education and the right of every child to be able to see themselves in, see themselves be represented in the curriculum. And when I talk about curriculum, I talk about the curriculum that's written, like the ministry documents from the Ministry of Education, that curriculum. So that kind of direct curriculum, but also that indirect curriculum, that curriculum that is about what they see in the schools, who's in the front office, the, you know, how people are spoken to when they're coming. So all of those pieces are put together. And when we talk about, you know, urban education, every child has a right to see the world the way it should be. And I think that's how I come at teacher education. So the teacher candidates now, whether they're teaching in downtown Waterloo, downtown Montreal, downtown Kelowna, or you know, the little town of Arthur, right? That sort of focus on what the world should be and what the world could be in a space where we have a just society, I think is more the focus of what I feel is important for teacher candidates to know, right? It does mean that they need to think about how to change the world. And I have, and I now I'm feeling like I'm on my soapbox now, because it is, I don't know that there's any other profession that changes the world the way we do. And I feel somehow that it is the teacher candidates who are coming through this process now that is so different than when I went through it, because now people know more, so they have to do, they know more, so they have to do better. And so as we think about, it's not just good enough that we talk about culturally relevant and responsive pedagogy when we have children in front of us who are multicultural, multi-ethnic, multilingual, multi-everything. If you are sitting or standing and working with a group of children who are mono-ethnic or all come from the dominant society, you have a group of children in front of you who are all white and who are all have parents who are very wealthy, those children deserve to understand what the world could be just as much as all those other children. And so when we talk about culturally relevant, we can't stop and say, okay, well, wait a minute, all these kids all look the same and they all look like the dominant society. So, well, what's culturally relevant for them? No. It's about, they have the same right to be experiencing a world of understanding who's in the world, what's happening in the world. Why are there people who don't have food in the world when they do? That's just as important. And so when I talk about, that's why I don't like to use the term urban education, because I think it mean, then it, I think it eliminates the fact that, how can I put this? And I think I've said this before, the children who come from families who rule the world, those children are going to rule the world. That's how it works, right? They have every economic, every social, every educational opportunity. And with few exceptions, they are going to rule the world. If we don't change what we put in front of that group of children, it's never going to change, right? If they still look at how they hiring practices when they get to be business owners, the fact that they need to have equity, diversity, and inclusive segments of their the factories that they own, how all of those pieces, if we continue with the same stereotypes and perceptions that they have, then the world will never change. So we have to do different. And that's what urban education is. It really isn't about urban education. It really is about education that changes the world. That's maybe social justice is a better way that I would frame it.
No, it makes sense, because urban education is kind of like locating conversations about marginalization, conversations about inequity to like one place. Whereas in reality, you actually need to, conversations about equity and inequity aren't just the purview of folks who experience the most marginalization. It's also like those who will eventually have like more choices, more decision-making power. Like they also need to be looped into those conversations as well. And like, I love the fact that, you know, that's deeply embedded in sort of like your approach to pedagogy and like teacher education. So awesome. So the next thing I wanted to ask you about was just about some of the biggest challenges that you faced in tackling literacy as an equity issue in your work. What's the biggest challenge in making sure that equity is prioritized in teacher education, or that sort of, you know, you can go about sort of doing this social justice oriented education, no matter who is sort of in that classroom or who is sort of like doing the teaching that you sort of described in the previous question. So understand that's like, you have sort of this lifetime of amazing experience sort of as an educator, you know, carrying this work out. But I would imagine that it's probably not been an easy thing to do, and that there's been a lot of changes over time, but also that difficulties are cyclical, and they pop up again. And so I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about maybe some of the challenges you face in doing your work.
Mm-hmm. I've been very lucky to work in a space that has allowed me to, you know, kind of try to push that envelope, right? I mean, working in the Toronto District School Board, although, you know, it's not perfect by any stretch of the imagination. However, there has always been a space that has allowed me to say, whoa, wait a minute, that is, we need to do more than what we're doing now. And certainly not just me, right? This has been an entire perspective, an entire board movement to say, we have to do better for our children of color. We have to do better for our children whose first language is something other than English. And so, so in that sense, I've been lucky. Over the course of time, when we've looked at literacy, one of the first pushes has always been, it's not just about the picture book. Now, I mean, I have probably 1,000 picture books in my house, right? And so I'm a big picture book person. And so when we first started thinking about how to be more inclusive in classrooms, of course, the first thing was, well, we've got all these beautiful picture books. So we can start with that. But I think what happened, of course, was, then that became the stopgap, especially in the early grades, because teachers could pull out a picture book, they could read this picture book that had a protagonist of color or talked about other languages or, you know, had children in saris or we had gay families. We could do it all with the picture book. And then all of a sudden, I think we started to think about, well, maybe like, we need to move beyond the picture book. And again, that how we did that, it almost got divided into two things. There were the systemic pieces, you know, what was happening in boards of education, at faculties, what was happening there. And then there was the issues about, you know, teachers working with a specific child who was in front of them. And so those became two different issues. So the teacher working with the child in front of them and what they could do as the classroom teacher, where they had never thought about their own responsibility, because of course I'm inclusive. of course I do everything I can for all of my students. Of course I'm doing the best I can for this particular child. The reality is those teachers had never thought of themselves as part of the issue, right? As being part of the system, because they are working with the children who are in front of them. And this is, and honestly, this is through no fault of anyone's, right? There are, I don't know how many teachers there are in Canada. I'll just use a Canadian example. And each one of those teachers works for a board of education, which each board then is responsible to a ministry of education, which is a provincial thing here in Canada. And education is politics, right? From that level, at that ministry of education, all of those people, it is a political piece that happens. And every teacher in front of a classroom is part of that political machine. And at no point when they are standing there in front of a child in front of them who is struggling with literacy, are they going to say to themselves, okay, let me think about the politics of this with this one child. They just can't do it. It's an unreasonable expectation that we have. The biggest struggle in how we can acknowledge literacy as an equity issue is that the politics gets in the way. Those, if the money and the right wing, left wing, middle wing, all of those pieces could be focused on the teacher and the one individual child in the classroom, then that struggle to move it would not be as great. But we know that can't happen. Our system will not allow that to happen. And when we talk about the systemic issues in education, that's what the systemic issues are, is that we, every 4 years or every 8 years, maybe there's a different government. Every 4 years, there's a government that needs to be reelected. And education is a massive amount of money that is spent to educate children. And the other side of that, of course, is we have those people who feel that we need to spend more money on crime prevention, and we need to spend more money on hospitals and all of those things. And there's only a certain amount of money that can be spent. So where do we put our dollars? And so when we don't support the students who have the most learning challenges in our system, then that just keeps perpetuating and keeps moving forward. And where does equity and literacy fit in all that? Well, what do you mean? No, we can't focus on equity when we have children who are throwing chairs, right? We can't focus on equity when we've got to do, where are the children going to learn about mental health issues? That's coming up there too. So it's hard. I don't know how to put it. It really is hard. So I think that's been the big struggle in how we, how we address it. I mean, I think about, this teaching at OISE right now, there's a basic lesson plan that every teacher candidate, every teacher uses to begin your planning for what you're going to do. We have just looked at how do we get teacher candidates to think about equity when they're planning their lessons, when they're starting to think about it. So we now have on the lesson plan, it says equity, diversity, inclusion, and indigenization. There's a set of questions so that every single time a teacher candidate starts to think about a lesson, they have to start to think about are there equity issues? What have I done to think about myself as an educator and to locate myself so that I am ensuring that there's some inclusion happening in my classroom, What are the resources? What resources have I used to change? Now, that's a struggle for teacher candidates. It's a struggle for instructors. It's a struggle for the associate teachers who are working with them, right? Because we are putting it front and center that says, every time you do a lesson plan, you need to think about equity, diversity, inclusion, and indigenization. And what does that look like? I mean, and it's part of this, that question we're talking about, because I think there's some fear, right? I think there's fear of doing the wrong thing, fear of alienating parents, fear of parents coming and saying, you can't teach my child that. That's not in the curriculum. So there's that fear part. But then there's also the, I've never thought of this before. And how do we distinguish between a lesson that is about equity directly? So somebody sent me one the other day that was amazing. And it's about the gingerbread person. And it's the outline of the gingerbread person, which at one point we called the gingerbread man, right? And it is a way of looking at sexual identity, sexual orientation, the biological sex, and sexual expression. So four different ways of looking at just by looking at this gingerbread person. Now that's an equity lesson. Right? That is a lesson that is obviously about equity. It's easy to think about. We've got all the issues. Okay. So now we're going to teach, and I'll just pick one that I just observed the other day, calculating mechanical advantage in science. And I have a teacher candidate sitting in front of me going, Marguerite, this has nothing to do with equity. Well, you're right. It doesn't. It's not an equity. You're not doing an equity lesson. This is your science about calculating mechanical advantage. I'm not even sure I know what calculating mechanical advantage is myself. I'm learning all about this as I sit through this lesson. But I say, so when you are teaching that lesson, what have you thought about yourself as how you are including all of the students in this lesson? Who's putting up their hand to answer the questions? Right? And when you look at those students and you see that, is it all the boys in the class? Is it all the girls in the class? Are you using inclusive language, right? All of the, you know, my poor students now, they've had 2 years of being online. So they're all doing masses of PowerPoints that they do for all of these lessons. So when you put together all those PowerPoints and you use all these visuals and all these little cartoony characters and things, again, who are you using? What are you choosing? The mechanical advantage of all the hinges and all those things. And as they put this together, how are you putting together so that students in the class understand that you have been thinking about how to make this an inclusive lesson? It's not an equity lesson. And so, but you can see the fear in their eyes when they get down, as they're talking to me about the lesson plan and they're getting closer and closer to the little box that says equity. And then they think, but Marguerite, I don't know what to say. What do I put in this box? And I think, as I said to the group that we're talking about, at some point, the box needs to stay there. And as we move through this process, it will be less and less about what I'm putting in this box, because not only now that they are teacher candidates and it's in a box, when they become teachers, they will have teacher candidates coming to them. And then they will say, what are you doing about equity, diversity, inclusion, and indigenization? Even if it's not in a box in a lesson plan, because it becomes part and parcel of what they do all the time, every day. And they're able to articulate what it is that is important to them. I mean, of course, I hope that they all become teachers of change, knowing full well that they won't all be, but it's just, you know, it's my dream. I'll stick with that. Does that answer your question, Hina?
It does. It also just made me think, actually, about, it's so interesting hearing you talk about doing this work and this thought process with like what I would assume are sort of STEM-based teacher candidates. But this is like very similar to the process that were sort of the conversations that are being had like among like science faculty, right? Because NSERC now requires that, you know, like even at this level, like in the university, like I'm glad to see that this is a thought process that's sort of like this sort of approach to thinking about like, how is this relevant to me? Like, what does this mean to me? Like, even if it's not directly, like you said, a lesson about equity, that there are ways in which like a scientist should also be thinking about this, right? And so I actually feel that your explanation of like guiding sort of like STEM-based teacher candidates in how to think through this process is it's something that I think science faculty, science like researchers, like within academia could also benefit a lot from, right? Like how, what does this mean for me? Like how, when I look at my classroom, when I look at my lab, like who is there and like who isn't, and like why is that happening? And are there things that I could be doing to change the way that, you know, this place operates that make this place more equitable? So I actually thought it resonated quite a lot. And I think that there's a lot that other listeners could also learn from what you just said. So I really appreciate that.
Okay.
So my next question is that, you know, you've had this amazing 30 plus year career doing like the actual work of addressing inequity in literacy and in the classroom space. And within that, you took on leadership roles as, you know, vice principal, principal, superintendent of schools, and you retired, and then you've been sort of like prepping the next generation of teachers to continue on this work. It's pretty amazing. So what's next on your radar is the question. Are there like upcoming projects or new work that you're planning to do? I just was curious. Yeah.
Well, actually there are a couple of things. So one of the things, I mean, I'm really hoping that I'm going to continue with the teacher education for another little while. Again, you know, it's all about, I'm just going to say, hopefully that will all continue. I'm doing some educational consulting work with an organization called Maple Bear. They're an international school that runs Canadian curricular kinds of schools all over the country. So I'm going to do some work. I'm going to do some work in Brazil with their teachers in schools. And I think it'll be really interesting to see what that looks like from an equity perspective. I don't, I'm going to go and I'm going to observe and see and see how I can interject a little bits and pieces. I think it'll be very interesting. Obviously most of the children that I'll be dealing with there are children of privilege. These are all private schools. And so it will be very different, and certainly in a different cultural context. So there's that. And also right now, the Human Rights Commission just released the Right to Read report. And I'm struggling to think about what that is going to do to the next generation of children. We as an organization in terms of education in Ontario, I'll just stick to Ontario for now. We have not been able to serve our students who have special education needs in the way that they should have been served. That is, again, a systemic political issue. And what's happened is that the Human Rights Commission has taken that on and put out a report around the Right to Read that has equated that with the need to in a very simplistic terms, what the political piece of back to the basics phonics education and the Ministry of Education has responded with a, you know, yes, we're all going to go back and teach phonics, and that's the way it should be done. And we should never have moved away from that. And teaching reading for meaning is, you know, it's not scientifically based, et cetera. And I'm not being as articulate as I should about it, because I'm still trying to absorb the whole thing. And really trying to think about, you know, what's next for the children of this province, if that's the direction we go in. There's a part in the report where it talks about word reading, and they use that term a lot about word reading, as if children have a stack of words in front of them and they, I don't know, almost like they're cards, and they flip up a word and then they flip up another word. And in those contexts, when children are reading, and when we take it out of a literacy, and I'm going to go back to my literacy as an equity issue context, the making of meaning when we are teaching children to communicate orally through the written word, and the ability to engage with others that have written something for them, meaning, you know, a textbook or a novel or a picture book or anything, when we are teaching children to be able to communicate that way, it is not about reading word for word. It is about making meaning, and children will not be able to engage in the world in a way that will allow them to make choices if we go to a point where we are not focusing in on them making meaning from text. And I am mortified that we are taking what should have been a very clear direction to the ministry to say, our children who need special education support with learning disabilities, with dyslexia, with behavioral issues, need more support. They need more funding. They need more assessment. They need more specialized instruction, and teachers are not the reason that those students are struggling in school. It's not because teachers are ensuring that children use multiple ways of engaging with text that those students are struggling. That's not what's happening. This is a political decision that has been made by generations of politicians about how much money is going to be put into special education and psychological assessments, et cetera, et cetera. And once again, they have put on the backs of the teaching profession that it is somehow our fault that we are not teaching scientifically, which I think is, you know, frankly, hogwash. It's not true. It's not true at all. And so I'm just trying to figure out, like, what's next? And do I have a part to play in that? I mean, I've done 30 years of this. I think I might need to leave this to other people, because it's, you know, I have 4-year-old grandsons in JK right now. And I cannot imagine those two little, very engaged, articulate, lovely little boys sitting and talking about cat, sat, mat, hat, bat. What's the point, right? It makes no sense. And then Mick, sick, lick. I am horrified that those two little boys are going to move from let's read a story and looking at all these things and being engaged and immersed in literacy so that they can engage in all of the pieces of literacy that they need to in order to be successful. And And the thought that, you know, some teacher when they hit grade one or even before that is going to remove the depth that they need to engage. And worse yet, all of these children who at no point in that report does it talk about how we need to ensure that all of those children see themselves engaging in literacy, engaging in communication, and engaging with each other. The whole oral language piece is, I didn't see it there, except I think there's a line. And how do we, like, how do children engage in literacy if they don't talk to each other? Anyhow, I'm probably soapboxing again, but I was just so horrified by the whole thing. And there's been lots of response to it that's been good. But there's also been a Ministry of Education response that says, all right, people, we're not going to talk about reading for meaning anymore. We're going to talk about word reading. And I know, and we have so much research, because if you think about it, the Americans, that's what they did, right? That whole No Child Left Behind, billions of dollars that they spent on their back to the basics instruction, what have they changed, right? And I'm going to say probably in the 1950s, when we had Run Dick Run, Run Jane Run, and all that stuff, where, you know, we had this little white girl and a little white boy running after the little dog and all that kind of stuff in their lovely little picket fence house. I mean, we can't go back there. That was ludicrous, right? So we need to do better. We know better. We need to do better. And I'll be honest, I'm not sure where that's going. So, or where I'm going with it. And maybe it's just going to be, I can rant. I'll just rant about it for a little while. Go from there.
I think this actually segues really well into the last question I had for you. What calls to action you have for listeners who might want to support the work that you're doing? And do you have any calls to action for listeners, especially in those sort of decision-making spaces?
The basics are the same for both of them, right? I think whether you are an individual person or you're part of you're part of the system, in both spaces, you have to start with examining who you are and what you believe and what you understand. And if you don't know, find out, right? I think that's in both systems. If it means that you have to sit through another session in whatever organization you work for on equity, diversity, and inclusion and indigenization, and stop rolling your eyes, stop saying, why am I here? Stop saying, I know all this. Stop saying, this is about blah, blah, blah. And just listen. Get over yourself. Get over your, why are we talking about this again? And take one thing away from each piece. There is so much out there. There is not a single person in the world, well, I shouldn't say that, because there are people who are not literate yet, who can't go to the library. Every library has an equity diversity shelf. Take out a book, right? And so whether you are an individual or whether you're part of the system, it needs to start with yourself. What are you doing? How, when you walk down the street and you see people, who do you see? What are you thinking of? What's going through your head? And is it fair? And is it right? And is it kind? And is it just, right? How do you operate in the world to allow yourself to be open to others? Other people, other cultures, other bits and pieces of information. And so I think that starts. So then I guess for the individual, be open to listening to other people, be opening to hearing other ways of thinking about it, and get out, go someplace, right? Go see someone else, right? Whether it's on a screen or whether it's on a, or whether you get on a plane wearing a mask, get on the plane, wear your mask and go somewhere else. For teachers, it's different, right? I mean, the judicial system that teachers are held to a higher accountability than other people. And I think it's true, right? Teachers are, our call to action needs to be different than the person who is a banker or the person who is just the person on the street. You know, our call to action has to be about every child who is in front of you. They are somebody else's child. And the reality is that the choices that you as the teacher make for that child are going to impact them in more ways than the banker or the person on the street. That is just the reality of the profession that you have chosen to be in. So take that very seriously and think about it every time you make a decision as to what you're putting in front of children. If you're part of the system, if you're part of the system, holy smokes, you're really the only way it's going to change, right? And I don't know, I was going to say, get over yourselves. But I mean, I'm not naive. The politics of this is so deeply ingrained in how we as a society operate. And the big P politics of the vote, who we vote for, who we choose to vote for, why we choose to vote, there's that big P politic. But then there's the little P politic, the choices that we make, you know, what kind of car we drive, what, do we use gas or do we use electric? Do we have solar energy? Do it, right? But it all comes back down to, if we do not create a literate society, they are never going to understand what's the difference between a gas engine, a diesel engine, and an electric engine. And that's why people need to be literate, right? There's nothing will change, right? When someone says that, you know, solar power is causing, what was the last one? Something, you know, cancerous something or the other. If people aren't literate, someone's going to say that and they're going to believe it because they don't have any other option, right? There are very literate people who use their literacy to only propagate the status quo and to keep what is theirs and to not even think about how the rest of the world needs to have more, and we as a society could certainly do with less, even knowing that we don't actually have to do less for others to have more. It's this funny, weird thing. So like I say, I'm not naive enough to think that it's only about literacy, because it's not, right? There are, but I do still feel that if we could get enough, a groundswell, that our political system would be different, and and the world would be different.
Yeah, it sort of goes back to, if you only have the capability to just intake what you yourself are perceiving versus mm-hmm. literacy, which is being able to discern something beyond your own lived experience and perception, that you can be more critical. Well, Marguerite, thank you so much for joining. I really loved this conversation. I really loved listening to you speak about, I don't know, just your whole life of experience. It was really, I feel so like privileged to be able to hear it. So I'm so grateful that you took the time to chat with us today.
Oh, Thina, thank you for allowing me to soapbox and rant for a little bit. It's
I loved it.
Thanks so much for listening. You can listen to our other episodes at radiolaurier.com. Funding for this episode was provided by the Office of the Associate Vice President, Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion at Wilfrid Laurier University and the Canada Research Chair's EDI stipend. This project also received support from Radio Laurier. Music was provided by Cameron Cochet.